Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connections Monday edition. Today's date is the 24th of March, 2007. My name is Daryl, 2008. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. Sorry about that little date and time mess up here, but, gotta read it off the small screen, and my eyes are getting old here, I think. Anyway, lots to tell you about. We've got a guest today, of course, and, so much has been happening here. There is a groundswell coming in from different places around the world. One of them I have been so happy to watch is the German public. And you know, one of the things that helps us is the actions of the bad guys of this Zionist criminal group. I've always said that the greatest asset we have in this fight is George Bush. Now, a lot of people are trying to get George Bush out of office. I want the man to stay right where he is. I think he's doing a great job of converting people who normally would not have even bothered to look at this information into staunch supporters of the truth. And for that, George Bush needs to be given the attaboy, George. We need people like George Bush out there to muck things up to the point where people are so sick to their stomachs of watching what's happening that they actually look into the facts. And this is what's happened by and large. If you take a look at the flow of people into demanding answers for all this stuff, I think George Bush is probably responsible for 25 to 30% of the world's waking up. Now, Merkel had played the same role. She went over to Israel, cameras blazing, film at 11 kind of thing, and just put her foot in her mouth, statement after statement, enraging the German public. Again, their own worst enemy, and in fact, she has been a fabulous recruiter in the nation of Germany for the facts. And then again, I'm going to get to my local knucklehead here, Mr. Sarkozy. This guy is a joke, and the French public is already ashamed of him. This is exactly what the public around me is saying, and it's what the press is saying if you're actually reading honest accounts. Now, since the Zionists control most of the mainstream press here in France, you don't get much of the real truth, but people are ashamed of this man. That's exactly what they're feeling. They feel that, you know, he's a manipulator and a liar, and they can't believe that he put this Jewish woman from Italy, Carla Bruni, into the position of First Lady of France, when there's pictures of her naked on the internet and other things. I mean, this is an affront to the French sensibilities, and I mean, it's hard to get the French upset about things like that, so trust me. But they don't expect their president's wife, the First Lady of the country, to be naked in public places. So these people actually are working to benefit us, and oftentimes you'll find that the crooks themselves mess up their own game plan. And recently, too, here in France, a sub-prefect of the area called Charente-Maritime, which is a coastal prefecture here in France, he spoke out on a internet website about the Israelis actually shooting school children as they leave school, but he said, but they do take a break for Shabbat, for their Seder. And he said that kind of tongue-in-cheek, that these snipers don't actually shoot them during the Shabbat, which is, saying that, you know, they stop being monsters at least for their religious day off or whatever. But for that, he got kicked out of his job. He got fired. And what they don't understand is that it brings more people to the issue, not less. And I think, you know, anybody who's been watching what's been happening to the Palestinian people are aware that as this country, Israel, it's not a country, it's as this criminal gang, Israelis, continues to murder the Palestinians and genocide them, the facts are not going to match what people are seeing, what people are seeing on their TV screens. And this disconnect between what they see and what they know is going to force them in many instances into finding out the truth about these people. And I couldn't be happier about it. We, again, here at the French Connection are not against Jews. We are against Zionists. And Zionism is a political movement. Judaism is a religion. We stay away from criticizing the religion of Judaism, because it really has no place in a modern context for me to be sitting here saying this religion does this or that or the other thing. Religious doctrine or dogma, if it remains in a text form and in a belief system, is fine. If it is taken into an action state and then injures other people, that's when it becomes a problem. You know, Muhammad Rafiq said it in a couple of files ago, you know, I don't care if you hate me or whatever, but it's when you act on that hatred, it becomes wrong. It's the same thing for religion. I don't care if your religion says, you know, you should be supremacist or whatever. It's when you take those belief systems and put them into motion and make them actually part of your physical daily agenda and make things happen to bring about those kinds of activities, that's when it becomes a crime against humanity. And Zionism is a criminal enterprise, and it constitutes crimes against humanity. They control America, they control Britain, they control France. They are in control of Germany, ladies and gentlemen. Turkey also. Jordan is under their thumb. Egypt is under their thumb. Italy is going back and forth here. There's a battle going on there. We've got ex-prime ministers speaking out against these crooks. The Spanish at times have moments of honesty and clarity. You know, the Netherlands controlled 100%. Sweden, sadly, under the thumb. The Russians, oddly, show signs of wanting to break out, but then they do the very opposite of what you would expect from somebody trying to break free from Zionist control and actually remain quiet when they should be speaking out. So I still can't get my finger on what they're doing up there. Anyway, that being said, I have a great guest. He's been with me at least a dozen times for different reasons, but for the last four or five visits, he's been describing for the listeners his book. We've been going through his book called The Synagogue of Satan. We put the latest installment on the website from 1936 on up to 48, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. Let me go to the top here. It's, yeah, from 36 to 48. We're going to discuss that today with Andrew Harrington Hitchcock, a friend of mine, an honest researcher, a brave man, a great guy to have as a friend, and somebody I admire. I really admire this guy for his ability to separate wheat from chaff, as he did in this book, and then do it from from his conscience. He wrote this book as an act of his conscience, I believe, and it's just a pleasure to have him here. Andrew, are you with me?
I am, Daryl. Thank you very much for inviting me on your show, John.
Well, it's great to have you back. This sounds like a much better connection than we've been used to of late, so I'm hoping that it's going to show up as a really sound audio file, and we'll see how that turns out. We're going to start out here, Andrew, on 1936, which of course is the lead up to the World War. And I'm, you know, I was wondering, some of the things that the 1930s brought us all, we may have to revisit in the next installment, because that period was probably the most important 10-year period for world Zionism in history. Of course, it set up the really atrocious behavior that came out of World War II on behalf of the Zionists and the people who were fighting against them. But we start out here, it says, with regards to increasing in anti-Semitism, Germany, as Samuel Landerman, at the time secretary to the World Zionist Organization, in his 1936 book, Great Britain, The Jews and Palestine, states the following of the United States entering into World War I. He states that that it was the Americans who brought help to the Allies in World War I, and he also said it was the basis for Germany's continued hatred all the way up through World War II, which, of course, Benjamin Friedman seconds that as well. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, yes. I mean, we'll be touching on this in the next fall, because many of the listeners will be aware of the Judea declares war on Germany headline, which was, I believe, from 33. And essentially what the Zionists were wanting to do was to basically get Jews united around the world, because they were spread around the world, to band together with them and essentially just usurp the authority in the countries that they were in, and of course through the banking system. That's how the major Zionists have done that, and we see the result of it here.
Yeah, we do. And well, and here's the interesting thing here, that the German public in the 1930s, having been thoroughly bankrupted during the 1930 depression that went worldwide, but more than that, they weren't prepared even before that happened. In the 1920s, their reparations for war after the First World War was so onerous and troubling for the country, they couldn't even get themselves out of abject poverty throughout the 30s, so they were already set up to be in bad shape. And it was National Socialism that actually stepped in to try and fix that, but they used what the Jews had done to them as a motivator for the public to say, hey, we can rise above this, we can build our own society, we don't need help from these people, and by the way, we don't have to be paying back these reparations. And when you listen to Ben Friedman, having been at that first summit in Versailles back in 1918, I believe it was, when he was there with Morgenthau and Brandeis and Baruch and Untermeyer and the rest, he said that they knew there was going to be a second war as a result of the reparations that were demanded out of Germany. Now, this moves us into the next group here, where you just brought up a very good point in your book. Lewis T. McFadden. You want to tell his story? Because I think he's a real unsung hero in the flow of history.
Well, Lewis T. McFadden was a Republican congressman, and he was the chairman of the House Banking and Currency Committee. And he was actually chairman from 1920 to 1931. Now, I haven't looked into the details of the previous chairman or what have you, but of course there would have been a chairman of this committee when the Fed was brought in.
Yep.
And I wouldn't have thought that was loyal to the American people, as this guy certainly was. Essentially, what he continued to do was try and raise questions regarding the Federal Reserve, and he would identify the Jewish elements behind it. And they didn't like this very much, unsurprisingly. And this year, on October the 3rd, 1936, he was actually assassinated. And it was the third attempt they'd had on him. He'd been poisoned before, and he'd had shots fired at him. And so this really is this is someone that's worth looking up on the net for more information for people. His name is Louis T. McFadden. For the work that he was doing, he was trying his best to get the word out on these people back then, and if he had have done, then Darryl and I wouldn't be having to do it now.
That's right. That is exactly right, because it was the use of the Federal Reserve in America's preeminent position after World War II that gave the Zionists the ability to start really going global. They had their tentacles into the world through the British Empire, but it was through the American Empire that they solidified those gains, and they did it through the financial system, of course. Now, let's go on to 37 here. It talks about, in his books, Stalin, Trotsky, or Lenin, George Marlin states, if the tide of history does not turn toward communist internationalism, then the Jewish race is doomed. Now, this man Marlin, I've never heard of him. However, he was obviously a pro-Zionist, and he was pushing world Judaism toward this thing that Khrushchev actually talked about in the 50s, that the communists would end up imploding the American experiment from within, as he laughed about saying it. But what do you know about this guy?
Well, I mean, as you say, it is a pro-Zionist take, but the interesting thing here, of course, is we've got evidence here of the link between the Zionists and communism.
Right.
And with the Stalin, Trotsky, or Lenin, of course, he refers to communist internationalism and the Jewish race in the same sense, but Stalin was Jewish.
He had Jewish blood in him, but he was also married to a Jewess, and his girlfriend or whatever in his dacha was Jewish, and all his henchmen that worked a hand in glove with him were all Jews as well.
Yeah, and Trotsky, real name Lev Bronstein, and Lenin was Ulyanov, and you know, this is the classic situation where they're changing their names from Jewish names to Russian names to try and escape detection, but the evidence is out there. So yes, I mean, it's something that I threw into the book because I use so many different sources for for this, to try and get the message across to people, to show how much information really is out there that we can condense down so the listeners can really get as punchy evidence as possible, really.
Well, you talk about this man named William Joyce, a writer who moved over to Germany in advance of World War II, trying to do exactly what we're doing today and wake up the world to the Zionist menace. Was he successful? And what is it about this man that particularly brought him into your examination here?
Well, he was also known as Lord Haw-Haw, which was H-A-W-H-A-W, Lord Haw-Haw, and he was quite a posh English educated guy. He was a journalist. He knew a lot about this network back then, and essentially he could see what was happening with the Jews in control, if you like, of the country, and see where it was moving towards this war. And he actually decided to essentially say, right, I don't want to be English anymore, I'm going to go over to Germany. And he did his best from Germany to wake up the British, and he was actually broadcasting a radio program from Germany that you could pick up in Britain, and they weren't very happy about that at all. I think Ezra Pound did something similar, didn't he, in Italy?
Yes, he did. Yep.
America.
Yep.
And, well, because there's a couple of his quotes that, because incidentally, at the end of the war, he was, I think 1946, he was put to death. He was executed as a British traitor, and what he said on the
he was a traitor to the Zionist criminals.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. His statement. I'm only jumping forward to 46 because we're on the subject of William Joyce. Before he was executed, he said, "In death, as in this life, I defy the Jews who caused this last war, and I defy the powers of darkness which they represent. I warn the British people against the aggressive imperialism of the Soviet Union." So he's bringing the two together there, the Jews and the Soviet Union. It's best to leave the quote of that rather than go through the rest of it. He goes on to say that he's sorry for the sons of Britain who have died without knowing why.
Well, and aren't we in that same situation today with Iraq? And it's astonishing to think that that we could do such a repeat of history and kill our young men and women in uniform without cause, without instigation other than what's been fabricated. It's amazing to me. I can't believe that I watch this every day on my television screen. And still, we've got the French public now signing up more of their boys to go over to Afghanistan, so they're actually upping their participation in this lie and in the murder of Islamic civilians around the world. I'm sickened by it all. We get into Hilary Belloc. Now, Hilary Belloc is whom and why is he important? He talks again about communism and Bolshevism, doesn't he?
Yeah, there's a lot of information coming around about this at this time. And this is what's interesting, actually, to look at it, to look at this period closely. We've been to a few quotes, and they all seem to have something to do with communism and Zionism being together, or communism and the Jews being together. And so it's almost like a lot of these people are really trying to get this word out because they're thinking, hey, there's trouble going on in the world at the moment. We don't want another world war. These are experts. They can see what's going on, so they're trying to get the word out. Now, what he said here, and he's a noted historian, he said the propaganda of communism throughout the world in organisation and direction is in the hands of Jewish agents. As for anyone who does not know that the Bolshevist movement in Russia is Jewish, I can only say that he must be a man who is taken in by the suppression of our deplorable press. So yet again we have someone basically saying that the newspapers, as Henry Ford told us, history is bunk, the newspapers are just full of nonsense, and the listeners will be well aware of this that we've discussed on many occasions.
Well, my father-in-law, being in his 80s, watching television, sees Nicolas Sarkozy making the sign of the cross as he's at a public event, says to me that he can't be Jewish. And I said, Daddy, you really have to, pull your head out of the sand here, because This is the MO of these people, and you have to understand that they have no compunctions about lying about what their roots are and what they believe in. They will morph themselves into anything that is necessary to dupe the public. And he just doesn't get it. I guess at 87 years old, he doesn't get it. And I wonder if he ever will, but we get this guy named Professor A. Kussler and Kulischer. Now, Professor Kulischer wrote this. He said, "Germany is the enemy of Judaism and must be pursued with deadly hatred. The goal of Judaism today is a merciless campaign against all German peoples and the complete destruction of that nation. We demand a complete blockade of trade, the importation of raw materials stopped, and the retaliation toward every German woman and child." Now, this man said this stuff. And it was not dissimilar to what they called for in 1933. So he was actually giving it a little more pepper in 1936 and 37. This is 1937 he said this. He was actually adding a little bit extra fuel to his statement, saying that they should go after the women and children as well. Do you have anything else to add to this, Cretan?
No. It's just, again, another it's good to get these quotes from the Zionists themselves, and then you can actually see what they're really all about. And it's not about how terrible Jews have been treated through history and how they need a homeland. It's just they're just pure evil, as simple as that. And we'll see later on what's happening in Germany during the war, and how certainly at points kicking the bankers out, it shows how quickly you can turn a country around when you just remove their control.
Well, again, here we get the Rothschild, one of the Rothschild children, popping his head above the parapet here in his own criminal gang and making statements on April 28th. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, yes. He's actually a reporter asked him about the lease on his Piccadilly home and where he was going to live, because the lease was coming up. And he replied, "Nowhere probably, I just don't know, not till after the war anyway." And this is going back to 1937, so he knows that there's a war coming up. The other interesting thing with this Lord Victor Oxfeld, he's the same one that will go on to be the Prime Minister Edward Heath's policy advisor in the early 70s, and he was the one that got us into the European common market.
Geez, surprise, 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 huh? And you know, interesting, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to make a little segue here. People here in France buy the lie of Nicolas Sarkozy being this immigrant boy made good from Hungary, when in fact his grandfather was a chief amongst the Zionists in Salonika, Greece, the people instrumental, and his family was a prominent family in Salonika, for undermining the caliphate and the Ottoman Turkish Empire, and was part of the new Turk invasion into the Ottoman Turk Empire. And it was all Jewish. And this man actually, has his face all across of France here. And instead, he places himself out there as the guy that's a Christian and been brought up Christian values, when in fact his grandfather raised him in Paris. The same man that was in Salonika, Greece. So, you know, the deceptions here are numerous and continuous, and you just have to be aware of that. Again, we move on here. It says Rear Admiral Henry Hamilton, Bemish. And now, what is his importance here, Mr. Hamilton Bemish?
Well, again, we're going from the angle here of reasonably high ranked army guy in America, and he was talking to an assembly in New York, and this is what he said. He said, "In 1848, the word anti-Semitic was invented by the Jews to prevent the use of the word Jew. The right word for them is Jew. I implore all of you to be accurate. Call them Jews. There is no need to be delicate on this Jewish question. You must face them in this country. The Jews should be satisfied here. I was here 47 years ago. Your doors were thrown open to the Jews and they were free. Now he has got you absolutely by the throat. That is your reward." And so he's basically saying that when the Jews were welcomed into the government, that is when they took no time at all setting up their Federal Reserve, setting up their walls, and setting up their deceptions. And he's just demonstrating here that I disagree with him in the sense that, you know, as you and I both know, they were working at this, he might be close to that area, but...
Actually, during the Revolutionary War, their monetary influences were being felt.
Well, this is it. I'm thinking about the Andrew Jackson time, and we're going back to 1830 then, so that's a lot earlier. That's 100 years earlier, not 47. So, you're certainly on the right track, but I would just say it goes back a little bit further than he thought.
Well, here's one, and here's one of my champions here. Her husband was the Governor General of India, a society woman, a historian, but a bit of an amateur historian who decided to examine information and bring it forward because she thought she had stumbled onto something that no one knew about. What she discovered instead was that she opened up Pandora's box as far as the truth was concerned and was shunned for her discovery. Of course, Nesta Webster. And I've said before, I just love the name Nesta. It's a unique name, and it just holds a warming spot in my world, because if you read Nesta Webster's books, you are absolutely floored by the depth of her research. She is one of the best of the best. What does she say about all this?
Well, firstly, I'll just get in there, Dale, but of course you've got quite a few of her books, I believe, on your site.
That's right.
And I would encourage people to read those. They are excellent, and I feel very similar to the way she felt when I looked at this material. I didn't realise all this stuff was going on. It's amazing how easy it is to find out. But anyway, what she said in 1938, this is in a book called Germany and England. She said, England is no longer controlled by Britain. We are under the invisible Jewish dictatorship, a dictatorship that can be felt in every sphere of life.
Is there no truer statement ever made? I mean, look, today, your water that comes into your home is owned by them. Your electric system is owned through their corporate structure. Your car that you buy is owned by their corporate structure. There's virtually nothing you can say, do, or think in this modern world that does not go through the hands of Zionist Judaism. And again, it's a group of several thousand at the top, and controlling that, a few hundred, maybe 300 or 400 main people, and then rank and file Jews who are really not up to date on what's happening in their own community. They too are carrying out the acts of this group because they don't know any better. They don't know any more about these facts than my father-in-law knows. This man fought in World War II, my father-in-law, and he still doesn't understand what he was doing in the fight and why he was fighting. So why would the rank and file Jews who are donating to these organizations, these Jewish organizations, know any better? They don't know. And in fact, their community gets even more attention by propaganda than others. And the fact of the matter is, yes, we are under their control. And that is probably an understatement. We are under the boot of tyranny as we speak. Is that not true, Andrew?
Oh, it is, Darrell. And of course, when you think of this statement, made in 38, and we're now in 2008, we're talking 70 years later, and of course even then it was identifiable to be their control. Now it's just got to absolute lunacy that back then they were miles away from owning our public services, the idea of people paying for water, etc, etc, and now look what's happening. They just want to take everything over. They're going to be taking over the internal government structure, I think, will be next. You have employees that work for a local council, and now they no longer work for the council. They work for their own private company that gets money from the council to make their profits. And, it just goes on and on and on. And the trouble that these people have always had is that they're so greedy. They're like a snake eating their own tail.
Well, and the fact is that their hubris is what's sinking them at the moment. I hope, against hope, that we have a better show of it than the people fighting in advance of World War II, because it looks like we may be on the precipice of another world war at the hands of these criminals. There was a statement made here on the 1st of January, no, this is November 7th in 1938. a Jew named Herschel Garispan assassinates Ernst von Rath, a minor official in the German embassy in Paris. In December, Sir Oswald Mosley makes the following revealing statement on the allegations that the Jews are being persecuted in Germany. What is it that you would like to say about Mr. Mosley's statement, Sir Oswald Mosley? In fact, he was a very prominent British socialite. If you're a sir, and back in those days, it was even more important than today, I would imagine.
Well, yes, Oswald Mosley is very much hated by all the... he's regarded as a Nazi, a fascist, and hated by all the so-called politically correct establishment. But, you know, let's see what he has to say, and then we can make our own minds up. He says, supposing that every allegation were true, supposing it were a fact that a minority in Germany, i.e. the Jews, were being treated as the papers allege, was that any reason for millions in Britain to lose their lives in a war with Germany? How many minorities have been badly treated in how many countries since the war, or without any protest from press or politicians? Why was it only when Jews were the people affected that we had any demand for war with the country concerned? There was only one answer, that today Jewish violence controls the press and political system of Britain. If you criticise a Jew at home, then jail threatens you. If others touch a Jew abroad, then war threatens them.
That's right.
And of course, I mean, as we know, they hide behind the whole race, and so when you have situations, essentially the concentration camp system, which was the same in Germany and America, incidentally, when they were rounding up the Japanese in America, because you can't have people who represent a nation you're essentially at war with roaming freely in your country because they'll be committing all sorts of subversive acts.
Well, and here's what Rabbi Stephen Weiss says to you Americans out there, W-I-S-E, Weiss, president of both the American Jewish Congress and the Jewish American Congress, World Jewish Congress, at a rally in New York. He says, I am not an American citizen of the Jewish faith. I am a Jew. I am an American. I have been an American for 63, 64 of my years, but I have been a Jew for 4,000 years. Hitler was right in one thing. He called the Jewish people a race, and we are a race. Now, this is an interesting thing to bring up, because what happens with criticism of Jews in general, and I try to put a caveat to all my descriptions of the Jewish conspiracy by saying Zionist Jews, because not all Jews are involved. And in fact, prior to World War II, there were large swaths of the Jewish community who were outwardly militant against Zionism, and there are today Natura Carta and others that don't believe in this criminal enterprise called Israel. And in fact, one of the problems we've run into is that the Jewish question has become both a race, a country, and a religion. And so we've set up laws that say you can't talk about another person's religion. So what happens is it puts them outside of our ability to complain about them.
Yes, this is exactly correct, Daryl. And this is where we talked about these hate laws before. This is how they know what they're actually for. And that's why they're putting them into place, so they could avoid criticism by the back door. But the other interesting thing this Rabbi Stephen Weiss has said here, when he says he calls the Jewish people a race and we are a race, what's important here is that where we've said before that they will hide, they don't care, and we'll find out they don't care if a few hundred thousand Jews die, as long as they get their end. And so if they want Israel, and as a result of getting Israel, you're going to have to create some sympathy around the world for things that have happened to Jews, which have happened because of what these ones have done. They're quite happy to sacrifice their own people, but at the same time they'll get this rabbi here to go out and say, look, if you're a Jew, then your master is Rothschild, and you stick with him, you know. So they just hide behind these other people, so they can always hide behind the race. And so when people do turn against them, they'll turn against the whole race rather than these people at the top, who always generally remain untouched.
Well, let's talk about the big lie here about German industry. And this is an important point to make. And this is one of the reasons why we know that Hitler was playing both sides of the fence. We know that he was using financiers from the Jewish community, making deals on transfer agreements to Palestine. There were questions about who financed his rise to power in the early 30s. Where did he get his funding from? But then we can go even further back, where there's also questions about his origins being from the possibly from the Rothschild family itself through a maid in the house of one of the Rothschild families and so forth. But the point being here, IG Farben, Germany's largest company at the time, it became this big union company, IG Metall, right now. IG Farben is an offshoot of that organization's control. Now, talk to us about who they were and what their connections were.
Well, they were the leading producer of chemicals in the world at the time. They were the largest German producer of steel. Now, in 1939, they dramatically increased their production, and that was used pretty much exclusively to arm Germany for the Second World War. Now, this company is controlled by the Rothschilds, and this company, of course, as well, went on to use Jews and other people that they were put into concentration camps in Germany as slave labour. And also, which is quite interesting, is they were responsible for the invention or the creation, sorry, of Zyklon B gas.
Right, and Zyklon B, if you don't know it, ladies and gentlemen, is credited with the use in gas chambers, which if you go to a guy named David Cole, a Jewish gentleman who did a little bit of a investigation into all that stuff, you can get what this Jewish investigator believes about all that. I don't really make statements about those facts because I don't understand them well enough to put myself in jail over. But Zyklon B at the time was a well-known chemical for getting rid of mites and bugs that caused typhus. Am I correct in saying that?
Yes, you're absolutely correct, Al.
So it didn't have, if you were to be using that, it would probably be wherever you had large concentrations of people, you ran the risk of having serious outbreaks of disease. And so the bedding that you were using and the laundry and the sheets and stuff would need to be dusted from time to time in order to make sure you didn't have an outbreak. Now, that doesn't sound like a group of people trying, well, we don't go there with that. But anyway, you want to go on and tell me a little bit more about what you found with this IG Farben, because there's more here.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, with a result of sort of what they seem to be doing, it was just what I found interesting was the fact that it was Rothschild controlled. They were so closely involved with the system, the concentration camp system that we just discussed, when you know, you've essentially got Jews controlling the people that are benefiting off the camps, and then years later they're saying how terrible it was when there were the people controlling it.
Well, and now they want money back for that, man.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. They're just making up
at the time. Oh, well, yeah, there you go. And in fact, the people who suffered during those work camp events, actually, it's been proven in press reports that they generally don't get paid. When these fines and monies are dispersed, the rank and file person who was actually in some of these camps don't even get a disbursement of the money that was spent.
No, absolutely. I think there's something later on in the book about how Bronfman put something together like that and got a certain amount of money out of Swiss banks. I forget how much it was. But to date, nothing had actually left this. He got the money and nothing had actually come from him to the people. It was still sat in a so-called fund of some sort, but it hadn't gone to any of the people that it was supposed to be going to, and they were over in Israel, I believe.
Well, okay, here we go. He, like Abraham Lincoln before him, simply issued what money he needed in his authority. Now, you talk a little bit about how Hitler, in the lead up to the first part of World War One, II, began to use a barter system where he doesn't actually go through the international banker's system, but he was still doing deals to transfer Jews out of Europe to Israel on Nazi flying the flag boats. These boats had the Nazi flag flying on their stern, and they were brought right into Palestine and disgorging huge numbers of Jewish immigrants who decided they would prefer to leave Europe and go to this new experiment in the so-called Holy Land. But he was in, Hitler was doing all kinds of backdoor deals with the Jews all the way through this whole thing, was he not?
Yes, the Hitler question is an absolute enigma. You know, we're aware of the rumours that he was actually a bloodline Rothschild. There's a couple of books that mention that or hint at that. And again, we see him 1 minute going towards the barter system in Germany and literally bartering the surplus goods Germany had with the surplus of goods Germany needed from other countries without debt. And he started literally issuing what money was needed by the government rather than, and it was backed by labour, and it wasn't Jewish banking money. So you've got him turning against them there, and then you've got him helping them out with the migration of Jews to Palestine.
Well, and then, you know, one of the wealthiest Jews in Germany, the Max Warburg, was supplying funding for many of the industries, and he lived comfortably in Hamburg all the way till 1943. And it's interesting to note that in 43 he decides to get out of there, and within months they bombed Hamburg almost to the ground. But of course he had already just moved out, and history is a frightful thing to read these days because it's so different than what they've been spinning in our history books. Let's move on here to this Anthony Crossley, Conservative MP for Oldham, makes the following statement in the House of Commons in relation to the plight of the Arabs as a result of Jewish persecution of Arabs in Palestine. Now, this happens in the year 1939, I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct, Al. He says, I do not believe that there has ever been a debate in this house when this house would have been more justified in calling to the bar an Arab speaker to explain the Arab point of view from the viewpoint of his own countrymen and his own country. There are no Arab members of Parliament. There are no Arab constituents to bring influence to bear upon their members of Parliament. There is no Arab control of newspapers in this country. It is impossible almost to get a pro-Arab letter into the Times, a popular newspaper in Britain. There are in the city no Arab financial houses who control large amounts of finance. There is no Arab controlled newspaper advertisements in this country. There are no Arab ex-colonial secretaries. He goes on, and what he's basically saying here, towards the end, just to skip a bit, he said there is. Finally, and I want the Colonial Secretary to pay special attention to this point, tomorrow night there is to be a broadcast, there is to be himself giving the government point of view, there is to be the Honourable Member for the Don Valley to advance what is obvious in the Zionist point of view, there is to be the Honourable Member for Carnarvon Boroughs supporting the Zionist point of view, there will not be a supporter of the Arabs who can advance their point of view.
Well, and here's the interesting thing, and we're going to go into this in just the next part here. The transfer agreement that we've discussed already a couple of times here was taking large numbers of frightened rank-and-file Jews from ghetto regions of Germany and actually, as it turns out, in the 40s in Poland, and telling these people, you are going to emigrate from here over to, you know, this new place that we've set up for you. Now, this whole new place that they were setting up came at the hands of the Balfour signing and the implosion, intentional implosion, and this brings us back to Mr. Sarkozy's family and others, of the Caliphate of Turkey, the Ottoman Empire. And the British took over that Palestine region as a protector of that region. They became the governor generals of that region. And so the British were actually involved in shipping large numbers of Jews out of Eastern Europe. And the Germans were involved in it. And for every Jew that was shipped there, the Germans were getting a fee for the handling of the shipping and all this other stuff. My point being is that they were disgorging these people in this little harbor. It was a small harbor at the time, Haifa. It was a fishing village harbor, but it had deep water. And it was big enough, deep enough for large German boats to pull up and disgorge the people. And then they were going out into this area that had been populated by Palestinians for 2,000, 3,000 years continuously, and setting themselves up as the new de facto government, or the new de facto controllers. And when that didn't work, you'll notice right after the war, the Irgun was born and the rest of it. But my point is this. The actions of Hitler actually put this all into motion. He was not just a bit part player in this, that in fact he was instrumental in getting Israel founded and the Jews they needed to start that country there. So this giant cleansing of Northern Europe of its Jews into Palestine was aided and abetted by both Rothschild, Britain, and Adolf Hitler. Am I correct in saying all three of those things?
You are, Dale. And interesting, Lee, I think it was the TikTok on, he mentioned the book, which I subsequently got hold of, called Hitler, Father of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the thing here, the other book, you can look on the actual official documents of the collaboration between Hitler and the Zionist, documents. If you go to the New Trade Carter site or Jews Against Zionism and you look at their books that are available, one of those is there, which will go into, you'll literally have the physical documents then that show this collaboration taking place. I think the only time it really broke down was when he wanted to start sending them to Madagascar.
Yes.
And of course they only wanted the Jews to come to Palestine, because what essentially you've got is you've got the Rothschild family who want their own country. Now, to have your own country, you're not going to have much if you just, they could have bought all that land over there and just put a little house in the middle of it, but you need a population. You know, a country without a population is meaningless. And so what they're doing here is they're like, right, we bought our own country, or we're working on that with this formation of Israel we've got in mind, but we need a population.
Well, and not only do they buy themselves a country, they bought themselves a region in the world that had a built-in mythology that came with it.
Yeah.
And it was the knowledge that a mythology could be built around where they were going that became the important element to the selection of Palestine as its the destination. But here's the interesting thing. Today, because of the way that Hitler, his name alone, has been used over the last 60, 70 years, you can't even have a historical or intelligent conversation about what did or didn't happen without running the risk of looking like you're a supporter or a detractor of his in some larger sense, in some erroneous sense. In other words, I don't know for certain what his connections were, and neither does anybody else for that matter. But we can look at history and look at the actions he took from historical documentation and make suppositions about his activities. And it looks to me like the British himself and Rothschild and others were working together in this whole enterprise. And that would be in keeping with what's happened since World War II. And now, of course, this man was responsible for ordering terrible things on the Russian people, terrible things in France. He did, of course, but so did Mr. Eisenhower, both during and after the war. So did many people. There was a lot of horrendous and heinous acts that were committed in World War II. Ladies and gentlemen, 57 million died. That's no small number there. So the fact is, but this guy has been the lightning rod or the flashpoint for hatred against Germans since that time, and it couldn't be it's a yoke the German public has had to bear, and it really is not based in anything I can find from historical perspectives that is rational. And I think for the first time we're seeing the German public saying, wait a minute here, yes, Hitler did terrible things and others did, Eisenhower murdered a million plus of our people right in a field. let's take a rational look at this. And of course, they're being persecuted for it. They're being jailed for it. They're being just decried in the press. Let's go into a little bit of what Hitler had here in his 1940 statement. Here, you've got his Schlickenberger, whatever her name, and some of the ideas about behind his origins.
Yeah, there are a couple of books now. There's Jürgen Kohler in a book called Inside the Gestapo. This is him talking about Adolf Hitler's grandmother, who was Maria Anna Schickelgruber. He said in this book, a little servant girl came to Vienna and became a domestic servant at the Rothschild mansion, and Hitler's unknown grandfather must be properly looked for in this magnificent house. Now, then we have a guy called Walter Langer in his book The Mind of Hitler, where he states, Adolf's father, Alois Hitler, was the illegitimate son of Maria Anna Schickelgruber. Maria Anna Schickelgruber was living in Vienna at the time she conceived, and at that time she was employed as a servant in the home of Baron Rothschild. As soon as her family discovered her pregnancy, she was sent back home where Alois was born, Hitler's father. So I've always found that this is a bit uncomfortable with these two ones, because all they're saying is, you know, the grandmother went over there, worked there, and it was obviously the Rothschild that got her pregnant, but it could have been any sort of servants and what have you that did. And it's just, it's sort of weak information in a way. It could well be true. But I put it in there because I think it's relevant, and the picture of Hitler is such an enigma. I mean, as we've already discussed, as to, you know, he seems to be doing one thing to benefit people and one thing to benefit the Zionists. So.
Well, and not only that, there is evidence that he did have his family burial plot bulldozed, and it was in a Austrian Jewish cemetery.
Absolutely, yeah, I've heard that as well.
So, I mean, and you know, and I mean, as one always is, an employee of Rothschild, you know, I mean, I've had maybe, 50 people in my family employed by them, and what have you, 200 people in yours? Of course we do, you know, that's normal, right?
Well, these days as well, in terms of they control so many things, it's very difficult.
But, I mean, my point, it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek here. I mean, I don't know anybody who's ever been employed by Rothschild, so, I mean, the fact of the matter is that Hitler's family goes back to the household of Rothschild is very, very telling here.
No, I mean, there's no, you see, I agree with you there, Dale, because they're both saying that, you know, she did work there. She worked at that particular house. And she's literally gone from Germany over to there to work there. And so she's crossed, well, you know, it was a different sort of geometric then, but what I'm saying is, it says that she travelled over there to work there, so is there something strange there that they've not got somebody locally? Do you see what I mean? It's all, you know, it's very sort of shady, isn't it, really?
It is indeed. Roosevelt takes America into the Second World War by refusing to sell Japan any more steel scrap or oil. We know that oil had been found in the islands around the Philippines and Indonesia area and others other areas in that region. And of course, the Americans coveted that oil and then turned off the spigot to Japan, which actually has very little of its own natural resources. And they had their own designs on growing as a industrial power in the world, and immediately got shut down by the embargo against them. Now,